The White House's unruly neighborhood, crime, scandal, and intrigue in the history of Lafayette Square. The chapter, The Plantation Owner's Startling Army of Diversity. Some misinformed tourists, when they learn of the Jackson statue in the midst of Lafayette Square, believe it refers to Stonewall Jackson. But an image of the Confederate general is unlikely in the center of the federal capital. Along with Andy Jackson's decisive moves to preserve the Union during his presidency, his equestrian monument honors his crushing and extremely unlikely victory over the British Army on January 8, 1815, at the Battle of New Orleans. Jackson had a wild and event-filled life even well before that time. Slashed and scarred by a British officer during the American Revolution, even as he watched much of his family perish at the hands of the Brits, nearly dying in a duel with the most skilled gunmen of the Western states, engaging in countless other duels, almost dying in a hotel brawl during the War of 1812, when the brother of a colleague shot him in the back. After that war, he'd stage a raid into Spanish Florida, where he captured and hanged British agents suspected of instigating raids into American territory, while enraging both London and the U.S. Secretary of War, John C. Calhoun. When sculptor Clark Mills created the Andy Jackson statue in 1853, millions of Americans could still recall the War of 1812 and recall Jackson's triumph, which nailed the coffin on British hopes to overthrow the results of the American Revolution, namely America's independence and its relentless push west across North America. In 1815, Old Hickory's win shocked for two reasons. One, his smallish army of U.S. regulars and irregulars beat the world's most powerful military. Two, his force was the original motley crew. It was made up of disparate ethnic groups of Americans and non-citizens that, in today's parlance, were remarkable for their diversity. It was a testament to Old Hickory's will and to the skill of the assorted units that the U.S. overcame such a mighty foe. Before New Orleans, President James Madison and his party's Democrat-Republican Congress had suffered many setbacks after declaring war on Britain in July 1812. The losses surprised many, for when the conflict broke out, Britain and its allies seemed close to defeat on the main battleground of Europe. Their nemesis, Napoleon, had conquered almost the whole continent. That summer, he invaded Russia to make his rule in Europe complete. Then he could finish off the lone remaining obstacle to his supremacy, the island of Britain. With London reeling, many Americans thought winning the war would be easy. The weak British forces in British Canada would be readily overcome. Madison's friend, retired President Thomas Jefferson, wrote in August 1812 that the acquisition of Canada this year, as far as the neighborhood of Quebec, will be a mere matter of marching and will give us experience for final expulsion of England from the American continent. But by winter 1814, things had turned around completely. Napoleon's grand army of a half million men had dissolved amid the snows of Russia. Bonaparte, his conquests and throne lost, was in exile. An experienced British army and its huge, unrivaled navy, both vital to unhorsing Napoleon, could now turn their undivided attention on America, to teach those Yankees for daring to take on their empire again. Early in the war, several American invasions of Canada had collapsed. Then in August 1814, Royal Marines under Rear Admiral George Cockburn invaded and burned Washington, D.C., before being checked at Baltimore. See the chapter, The Burning of the White House and the Rescue of Its Riches. But far to the south was a richer prize, far richer than the humble American capital of 20,000 souls. The city of New Orleans lay at the mouth of three great rivers washing down the Mississippi Basin, the Missouri, the Ohio, and the father of rivers himself. New Orleans was the choke point to the continent. If the British could seize it, they could block much of America's products, timber, cotton, metals, corn, from reaching the outside world. The U.S. economy could collapse. Britain might even pry away the Louisiana Purchase and make London, not Washington, supreme again in the American West and in North America generally. Indeed, the Prime Minister, the Earl of Liverpool, thought his military should go on taking American territory until and unless it was stopped. To grab the prize, the British sent to Louisiana a large and well-trained force. It was made up of veterans of the Napoleonic Wars. It was commanded by Major General Sir Edward Pakenham, the brother-in-law of the conqueror of Napoleon himself, the Duke of Wellington. New Orleans, American turf for just 12 years since the Louisiana Purchase, was in a panic. Its citizens were largely French, Spanish, Afro-Caribbean, and mixed-blood Creole. Loyalty to their new country seemed tentative, and the city was practically undefended. Some spoke of cutting a deal with the advancing Brits. Mix and match. But bringing order out of chaos was the willful Jackson, then 47 years old, rail-thin, with steel-gray hair. After arriving in Crescent City in early December 1814, he acted fast. He imposed martial law and a curfew to restore order and to stop information about his army leaking to the British. He forced his rough-hewn soldiers to abide by local standards and army rules, namely to stop using the city boulevards as open-air latrines and to refrain from deserting sentry posts to visit the city's houses of prostitution. He picked as his aide-de-camp the head of the city's defense council, the brilliant attorney, Edward Livingstone. At social gatherings, Jackson charmed the town's elegant belles, who had envisioned the Tennessean as an uncouth rustic. Still, General Jackson was woefully undermanned. He had only 1,000 troops and a few gunboats. In contrast, the British were readying 8,000 troops, backed by about 50 ships. In mid-December, their fleet routed armed American schooners at a lake just east of the city. Desperate for manpower, Jackson became the most unusual recruiter in American military history. Jackson was a slave-owning planter and a Southerner who backed states' rights. Yet he accepted a request from Louisiana's governor, William Claiborne, that New Orleans free men of color would join his army. Informed the blacks were eager to prove their courage and patriotism, Jackson replied, "Our country has been invaded and threatened with destruction. The free men of color would make excellent soldiers. They will not remain quiet spectators of the coming contest." The blacks, paid as regular army soldiers, formed two battalions and numbered about 600 men. One battalion was from Crescent City, and a resurrection of an old unit from the days of Spanish rule. The other was made up of refugees from Santo Domingo, today's Haiti. It had been in chaos since a bloody slave revolt and a brutal French suppression. An army paymaster, reflecting fears of rebellion from armed blacks, objected to the recruits. According to historian Robert Remini, Jackson retorted, "Be pleased to keep to yourself the policy of making payments to the troops without inquiring whether the troops are white, black, or tea." Andy Jackson was a renowned Indian fighter. As president, he would infamously begin to expel the civilized tribes who had adopted American culture from the American Southeast. Yet he had adopted an orphaned Native American boy. He'd employed Indian tribes as military allies. The previous year, Choctaw Indians had fought as U.S. soldiers during a Major Jackson victory over the British-backed Creek Indians. Joining him at New Orleans, therefore, was a squad of Choctaws, about 50 in number. Adding to the jambalaya of Jackson's army were the citizen soldiers of New Orleans, including the Creoles of French and Spanish and mixed Caribbean stock. Further, pouring down from the frontier state of Tennessee and adjacent Kentucky to join in the fight were thousands of mostly uneducated but frontier tough volunteers. Many were of Scotch-Irish descent. Most were Protestant, unlike the residents of New Orleans, most of whom were Catholic. Many of the frontiersmen carried the accurate Tennessee long rifle, good for hunting bear or British alike. Some Frenchmen who'd fought with Napoleon and who'd fled to the New World joined the Americans as well, as did American horsemen from militias in Mississippi. Still, Jackson needed more fighters and a stronger presence in Louisiana's vast expanse of bayous. Livingstone's council urged him to parley with a band of French pirates operating from a bay 60 miles south of New Orleans. For years, their smuggling had sparked clashes with American authorities. Just 3 months prior, a clutch of American ships had defeated the pirates in battle. Jackson himself had proclaimed them hellish banditti. Still, some admired the spunk of these buccaneers, led by a charismatic Frenchman, Jean Lafitte. For his part, Lafitte reasoned smuggling would be easier under an American government than under British rule backed by the Royal Navy. He pleaded to Governor Claiborne, "I am the stray sheep wishing to return to the sheepfold." Besides, he was French, the mortal enemy of the British, and so a natural ally. Livingstone persuaded General Jackson to pardon Lafitte's men. In return, the freebooters joined Jackson's variegated force as sailors and infantry. Their experience with ship cannons also made them good with artillery, and their expertise with smuggling made them good provisioners. Some may have seen a 1958 Hollywood potboiler, The Buccaneer, starring Yul Brynner as Lafitte and co-starring as Andy Jackson, an actor known for playing larger-than-life figures, Charlton Heston. Though its accuracy is shaky, the film entertains. Jackson and his motley men threw together a veritable fortress to block the main land route leading into New Orleans. Behind the Rodriguez Canal, they shoveled up a rampart 5 feet high and 1,000 yards long. Laborers deepened the channel's ditch. Disputes broke out whether whites should perform the same laborious work as blacks. Anchored by the Mississippi to the west and a swamp to the east, the Rampart Canal made for a sturdy defense. Leadership matters. Given Jackson's various recruitments, the U.S. force rose from about 1,000 to about 4,000 men. The U.S. Army was still outnumbered about 2-1. However, Jackson was aided by the blunders of his adversary, General Pakenham. In the weeks before the fight, the British commander might have marched on a weakly defended New Orleans before Jackson built up his strength. But a cautious Pakenham waited for his own reinforcements. Moreover, instead of using a vastly superior navy to outflank the Americans, he determined on a frontal assault by land against Jackson's fortified wall. On the day of battle, Pakenham's army got a late start. Thus, the Delta fog was clearing when the Brits, with their bright red coats and loud marching bands, finally strode toward the Americans. Lumbering along on open ground, they made inviting targets. A bombardment preceded their assault, but the red glare of their normally fear-inspiring rockets whisked without effect over the American positions. Jackson calmed his men. "Don't mind these rockets. They're mere toys to amuse children." Incredibly, the British soldiers marched forward without bringing up sugarcane bundles to fill the canal ditch, and without ladders to scale the rampart. Neglectful officers had left both vital items behind in camp. General Jackson had carefully marshaled his men. Near the center of the rampart were 350 soldiers from the U.S. Army's 44th Infantry Regiment. On their right were the black battalions. Further to the right was the citizen militia of New Orleans, and the flank was anchored by the U.S. 7th Army Regiment. Left of the 44th Regiment were the Tennessee and Kentucky sharpshooters. The left flank was anchored by horsemen commanded by Jackson's friend and fellow Tennessean, the able General John Coffey. To the rear were the cannons, some manned by pirate crews. The British came within range. From the parapets and behind bales of cotton, the Americans poured out a storm of bullets and grapeshot from muskets and cannons and Tennessee long rifles. Each of the three line of soldiers would fire their muskets or rifles in turn, then duck and reload. A frontier informality marked their deadly work. The Americans handed each other bullets and powder, bantered and joked, and fired continuously. The troopers took skillful aim. The British leader, General Pakenham, was shot off his horse and killed. A general leading one of the two British columns was mortally wounded. The head of the other column was put out of action with a bullet in the groin. The attacking host turned into a writhing mass of red, some of it coats, most of it blood. Valiant Britishers, though wounded, continued to crawl forward toward the rampart and ditch. "Shoot low, boys, shoot low," shouted a U.S. officer. Rake them, they're coming on all their fours." Scottish troops rushed in to try to save their stricken comrades, yet some 500 of the Highlanders fell. A British unit from the West Indies attempted to outflank Jackson through the swamp. There, the Choctaw Indian scouts were waiting. They shot up the attack. Some of those wounded drowned in the bogs. In Napoleonic warfare, when things went south, a strategic reserve would be sent into the fray. However, the British reserves never entered the battle, in part because their bugler, in charge of sounding the advance, was shot in his playing arm. Another British force managed to cross the Mississippi, storm the positions west of the river, and turn captured American cannons against Jackson. However, they were ordered to withdraw when the main attack collapsed. The death tally revealed one of the most lopsided battles in military history, comparable to Cortez against the Aztecs or Pizarro versus the Incas. When the dust settled late that morning, Jackson's men had lost 13 killed and had 58 wounded. In contrast, the British suffered 2,042 casualties, with about 775 killed, captured, or missing in action. As many know, the brawl took place weeks after a peace treaty, worked out in Belgium, and formally ending the war. Word of the accord reached New Orleans too late. Under the Treaty of Ghent, the British pledged to no longer hinder or harass American expansion to the west. The battle guaranteed they'd keep their word. The Louisiana Territory, and in time all of the West, clear to the Pacific, would be America's for keeps, due to Jackson and his motley men. From The White House's Unruly Neighborhood, Crime, Scandal, and Intrigue in the History of Lafayette Square. Copyright 2019 by Edward P. Moser, McFarlane Publishing.